the Senate Education and General Government Committee. Please turn off all your electronic devices so that you do not rudely interrupt any of our speakers with your beeps and songs and whatever goes off on your cell phone. If you don't, and I hear it, you'll make a contribution to the Common School Fund, and hopefully we'll get a lot of money there this year, but we haven't had too many people violate that principle yet. I'm delighted to have you here. We're going to go a little bit out of order because I see we have an honored guest. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 47. I'll have Ms. Richardson bring us up to date, and then we'll call some folks forward.
Madam Chair, there, Senate Bill 47, the bill's before us as well as an amendment. Would you like me to describe both?
Please.
Senate Bill 47 directs the Department of Education to establish a system to review business practices of school districts and efficiency review teams. It establishes efficiency review advisory panel to advise the Department of Education on the system, the review results, and responses to the review results. It allows expenditures up to $1 million from the state school fund for use during the 2007-2009 biennium to administer the required activities. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1, 2007. The Dash 1 amendment is a gut and stuff amendment. Establishes a direct best business practices advisory committee to advise the Department of Education in developing a system for auditing business practices of school districts. It specifies that districts may volunteer to be audited and that the department will contract with the Secretary of State to perform the audits. It allows expenditures up to $1 million from the state school fund for use during the 2007-2009 biennium to administer the required activities. It declares an emergency and takes effect July 1st, 2007. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. We'll start out with Mr. Secretary Bill Bradbury. And I thought we had heard this bill before, colleagues, and I remembered we had it set, and then a little work group got together to go through two competing bills, and so I think that's what the Secretary is here to talk to us about this morning.
That's correct.
Thank
Madam
you.
Chair. Madam
yes.
Chair.
You didn't tell me he was going to be here.
Would you have dressed better?
Hey, Frank and I have the same tie on, different year. We're doing pretty good.
Okay.
This is an education
exactly.
committee.
I don't know if I've ever seen Senator Westland so well dressed. Madam Chair, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And state your name for the record, even though we know you.
Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State.
Thank you.
And I'm joined by Chuck Hibner, the Director of Audits in the Secretary of State's office. I really should be sitting here with the Lori Wemmer from the Oregon Education Association, Representative of COSA, Representative of OSBA, Representative of School Employees Association, and Representative of the Portland Public Schools and a representative of the Department of Education.
Mr. Secretary, there's not enough room at the table
I know,
for all those
but
people.
That's what's so wonderful we've finally come to on this bill, is we have proposed for a number of years as a Secretary of State to do auditing of K-12 schools. And we've really finally arrived at a compromise with all the various players. And so I want to thank Senator Walker for putting this work group together. And I also want to say that I had a conversation earlier this session with Senator Morse, and some of the comments that he had very specifically relate to we got to have some clear business practices to really be auditing about. And so that's really what we see in this bill. I think all of us understand that we're going to this session spend more than $6 billion state dollars on education. And the fact is we all know that it used to be that local schools got two-thirds of their support from property tax and one-third of their support from the state. That ratio, mostly because of the passage of Ballot Measure 5, has shifted completely. And now one-third of the money for local schools comes from local property taxes, and two-thirds of the money for local schools comes from the state general fund and lottery and the common school fund. So clearly there is an interest on the state's part in making sure that our money is spent effectively, and that's what's inspired us to be putting forward auditing K-12 schools. The compromise that we have here is basically one that says the Department of Education is going to really develop some best business practices for school districts. Because when you think about a school district, there are, 197 school districts in the state. Every one of them runs a transportation system. Every one of them runs a school lunch program. Every one of them maintains all their buildings and their grounds. So there's a lot, and then they all have all the fiscal accounting and contracting services. So you have 197, I think that number is correct, I'm not sure. Close. You have a lot of school districts, each one of which has a lot of business practices that they have to follow. So basically, the Department of Education is going to convene an advisory committee to really help them develop some proposed or suggested best business practices, and then they will contract with the Audits Division of the Secretary of State to do audits, to do audits of those school districts that want to be audited. So it's voluntary by the school district to be audited, but it's basically to see how the best business practices are being implemented. I want to just really say one thing. I want to emphasize one thing, and that is we're not talking about auditing education. I want to be very clear about that. We're not talking about educational practices. We're talking about business practices of school districts.
How they spend their money.
How they spend their money. Because we certainly have no expertise in what's the best way to educate kids. Okay, so I want to say that real clearly. And basically, through the work group, we came up with what I'm very comfortable with as a very good compromise to really start having the state follow the dollars that we're sending to local school districts through this voluntary audit program. And I just feel really, really good about it, and I'm very excited about it to see that we're finally getting to the place where we can move forward on it.
Well, and I appreciate that, because as long as I've been in here, we've been bawling back and forth trying to get to a resolution, and we just never seem to.
Right.
And the Senate Education Commission on Educational Excellence. Boy, that's a phrase I could never get right with our commission. But we dealt with this in the interim, and it was really important, and we sat down. And so when we came back, I was really pleased that all the parties decided that they could get together and actually try to solve the differences between your office and them. And I want to thank Ms. Wimmer Whalen for heading up that work group. She did a great job. Any questions? Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this amendment. Was there some reason that ESDs are not included in this best practice review?
Oh, I think my impression was they are included. Now, you better ask somebody who's more expert than I.
Maybe I better read the bill.
My impression is that, basically, ESDs and are included, school districts are included, and because school districts are included, that includes the things that school districts enter into, like charter schools. So basically, pretty much the whole educational world is included.
And line 11, thank you.
Yeah, and Senator Morse, they're also included on the advisory committee. There's a member from the ESDs on there. No, we wouldn't let this go without making sure that the ESDs were audited as well. Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I guess, Madam Chair, my real concern is, and I don't necessarily have a problem with what's in the amendment, but the part that's lost here, and I may be wrong, but as we were discussing it, Section 3 that would have the Department of Education establish efficiency review teams, because I perceive that as a lower level where a team would just go in and work with the district to try to find efficiencies without it rising to the level of audit. And I saw that as maybe a more collaborative thing. Am I missing something here? Ms. Wimmer Whalen says she can speak to that. I mean, the accountability and all that stuff is great, and I appreciate that. I just want there to be a lower level collaborative ability for the work to happen without the word audit coming in on it, because that sends up red flags and things like that. So.
Okay, well, Ms. Wimmer-Wayland can perhaps respond unless the Secretary has anything to say. All right, thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Secretary, we've been honored by your presence this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being persistent.
And as I said, thank you so much for putting the work group together.
You're welcome.
Has made a difference.
Thank you. I will call up the members of the work group next then, Ms. Wimmer-Wayland and Chuck Bennett. And I believe they will go over the details of the Dash 1 amendments and answer your questions,
okay,
Senator Cruz.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer-Wayland with the Oregon Education Association. I was the convener of the work group, which included all the parties that the Secretary of State told you about. And what I'm handing out to you is a matrix I prepared in advance of our meeting that compares the two bills side by side in terms of all of the different provisions and how they differ from each other. And then that third column over that's labeled remedy and reconciliation was blank when we went into our meeting. And you are seeing now what our agreed upon remedies were at the as an outcome of that meeting last week. And I wanted to thank all the members who participated. It was a very productive work group, and we all feel pretty proud of the work that we were able to accomplish.
Thank you, Ms. Wimmer-Wayland. Let me stop you for just a second, because I love these kinds of charts. They're very instructive. And Senator Morse, the third one down, shows that Senate Bill 47 had only had school districts subject to the audit. 71 had school districts, ESDs, charter schools, and alternative eds. And then you see how we remedied the two bills and made them collaborate together.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the Dash 1s before you had two mistakes in it, and so we're asking for a rewrite of those amendments. One was that the Oregon School Employees Association was inadvertently left off, and the second mistake was that our preferred report circulation order was misconstrued in the Dash 1s. It's our hope that the district subject to the audit would be the first person to receive the report, and in the amendments you have before you, that's not how it's ordered. And so we have the district subject to the performance review or audit, and then the Board of Education, and then, of course, the online posting by the Audits Division as our preferred method. So I think those changes are being made, and you'll see that in a Dash 2 amendment. But otherwise, the Dash 1s are faithful to this chart. And if you'd like, I can go over briefly the elements, or you can read them for yourself. I thought I would respond, however, to Senator Cruz's question. In the process that we undertook, we were trying to meld both the formal audit process and the more informal review. Mm-hmm. The idea was not so much that audits themselves were good or bad, but rather it was the mandated nature of involuntary audits that was most worrisome to the group, particularly given the tendency for those kinds of things to make it into the media as kind of a gotcha rather than as an aid for discerning best practices or even focusing on and spotlighting and rewarding districts who do engage in best practices, which I know was the idea of the Accountability Subcommittee of the Senate Educational Excellence Commission. And as a party, OEA is a party who could support either approach. I think that's probably why I was put in as the traffic cop, because we would have been able to live with either approach. And ultimately, the group decided to trade off formal auditing for voluntary. And that's one of the features I think is best about this, that districts can come forward, and many are prepared to do so, we know, as we speak, and volunteer to have their districts audited. And there's even a provision in the bill that says if there are, you know, a number of them and only a finite amount of resources to do audits in any biennium, that the advisory committee would be able to select a representative sampling from among all of those who would like to have it done, so that we anticipate that this will be a much more positive way of approaching auditing and still preserve the accountability feature that we all think is so important.
Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I guess what really attracted me, and I appreciate your work on our subcommittee. And we did look at this, and I remember, Madam Chair, that we did everything we could to avoid the word audit for some very, very good reasons. I guess the thing that really attracted me to Section 3 was, to a degree, its independence, and to a degree, making sure that the folks that are going to be going in and doing the review have the high level of expertise in the disciplines that are necessary, including educators. And I was concerned about losing that as we do this gut and stuff, because I thought that was a very good piece.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I actually think that was preserved because we still have the advisory committee. We blend the expertise of the Department of Education and the Secretary of State's Audit Division. I think we have actually a stronger bill as a result.
Okay. And Madam Chair, and I'm not going to oppose it. I just like the independent nature of what we created there. But we'll see how it tracks.
Okay. I agree with Ms. Wimmer Whalen. I think we have preserved it, and I understand where you were coming from, but I think this is a great start. At least we're out of the starting gates.
I agree, I think we're
going to get across the finish line this time as well. Ms. Whalen, let me ask you one question. In the Dash 2 amendment, I assume it's going to address line 21 on page 1 of the Dash 1 amendment. Sub 4, Section 2, Sub 4, the Secretary shall report the results of the audit first to the Governor.
Right, Madam Chair, that was what I was saying. We want it to go to the district first and then to the Board of Education.
Okay.
And our plan did not contemplate sending a report to the Governor per se. However, the Audits Division can post it online, so it will be public record at that point.
Okay, so the Governor will be deleted from...
Right.
I mean, we love the Governor, but... I mean, he'll be deleted from at least getting this report because he can get it online and they don't need any more paper in their office. I agree. And I agree. It should go directly to the district who participated in the audit. All right. So that's the small change you'll make there. And then OSEA will be added to the list. So we should have those back by Thursday. So I'm going to roll this bill into Thursday to get the work session, and we should just pop it right out and get it out Thursday then. Okay, Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, we've been actively involved in the discussion of these kinds of audits for the past several sessions that the Secretary has brought them. And I think for the first time we've really hit a point where we can actually agree with where we're headed on this bill. I don't know how else to describe it. If it hadn't changed, I think we'd probably be up here arguing again, probably ad nauseum, that we do undergo audits. We do audits at the local level, particularly of finances. There is active performance auditing that goes on district by district. But this bill adds a really new dimension to the discussion. And part of, I think, the change was the result of ITAC's audits done up in the metropolitan area of the various school districts that receive the ITACs and the positive feedback we got from all of those districts that underwent performance audits as a result of receiving those tax dollars. And what we heard back was this is really helpful to have performance audits. They were very pleased with the outcome. It gave them a lot of new insights into business practices and into a variety of their support services. In fact, we've had so much discussion inside the administrative community that there is, I can just absolutely assure you, there will be more than enough districts lining up of all sizes and configurations to undergo these audits looking for best practices assistance. I've talked to a number of recently installed superintendents who have had to go looking for someone to assist them with performance audits as they come into new districts. And it is difficult to find that kind of expertise. This bill will create that kind of very special expertise in the Secretary's office through the Department of Education, where we know best practices will be the foundation of the discussion and improvement of district operations the goal. And that is just exactly what school districts are looking for as both assistance and accountability from the state. And I think that's important to understand. The districts look for both. They do believe they're accountable, but they also ask the state, traditionally through the Department of Education, for assistance in larger issues. And this really follows the spirit of that. I really congratulate you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Wimmer Whalen for finding a way through what has been a very difficult discussion over, the past 6 or 8 years. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It sort of reminded me of Senate Bill 300 last session.
Oh, yeah.
That had taken years to come to a meeting of the mind, so to speak, and we did it, and I think we've done it here. And your point's well taken, Mr. Bennett, that I think districts are going to be lining up to participate in these, particularly as folks out there find out about this, they're going to be asking their school boards, hey, why don't you sign up to have one of these to improve the best practices in our district?
Well, I think we'll have, Madam Chair, school boards asking school superintendents, how about we line up for this too? Mm-hmm. I think that the elected leadership of the 197 school districts and the whatever 20 ESDs are going to want to have a look. Like you, we're sort of civilians in this world, and I think that for elected or appointed officials in these various capacities, the guarantee that their professional staff is working at peak is going to be very important mm-hmm. to them. So mm-hmm. I just think this will be a really successful step into this area. I fully expect to come back before you next session telling you just how well this went from our perspective.
Well, we're pleased to hear that, especially since Senator Cruz and I worked on the accountability work group under the guidance of Senator Metzger and Decker in our committee. So, any other questions? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the issue that Senator Cruz had raised with respect to the meaning of the term audit, and what I sense in this amendment is while we're using the term audit, and it typically implies there's a problem and then there's punishment. Now, the punishment can come in a variety of ways. The most damaging is in the eye of the public and lack of credibility and lack of confidence. What this does, it gives us an opportunity to change that dynamic in the same way that businesses aspire to become a Malcolm Baldrige Award winner or a J.D. Power recognized firm. So it changes that dynamic, and I think the potential exists, hopefully, and there's nothing in this bill that would prohibit this best practices, business practices committee and ODE to create a recognition process so that there is a gold standard, and those districts that meet it then can demonstrate to their constituents that, in fact, they are meeting best practices. So when they go asking for public support for education, that you have another way of demonstrating that, in fact, it is a well-run, quality administration. So hopefully, and I see you nodding,
and
hopefully there is nothing in this bill that would prevent that dynamic from occurring as opposed to a big club with an audit, and we're going to show the public where there are problems.
So, yep. You're certainly capturing the spirit of it from our perspective, Senator Morse. That's really what we're expecting. We're very, very hopeful that this will be nothing but a positive step. And certainly that doesn't mean there won't be light shone on not best practices, but that's important that that happen too. This can't, accountability is a two-way street, and we understand that. So there will be some difficult questions asked, and we look forward to seeing some really good common answers so that as you give us, you allocate the $6 billion with a B dollars to education. We hope the 7, 8, and 9 into the future $1 billion to guarantee the education of our children, that you'll feel very, very comfortable that they're being spent wisely. And I think this is part of that package of accountability that I know is so important this session.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you for your commitment to this process and the work group. Hearing no public further testimony, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 47. Colleagues, we'll get that amendment back on Thursday, and we'll just punch this right out on Thursday. So I'm going to open a public hearing on SJM 3. Ms. Richardson, why don't you tell us what that's about while people sort of work on coming on up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SJM 3 condemns state-sponsored violence toward its citizens in Ethiopia and urges the President of the United States and the Congress to reexamine the foreign policy toward Ethiopia. There is a dash one amendment. Madam Chair, would you like me to describe that? It changes the Ethiopian ambassador's name and the number of protesters killed by security forces.
Madam Chair, is the ambassador, does he approve of us changing his name? Or?
I think we made the mistake. Okay. But that's a good point, Senator Metzger. So if we have three guests at the dais, if you could just tell us who you are. And
absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sasha Pollack. I'm representing Senator Ryan Deckert's office. Thank you so much for hearing this morning. Our office was approached last year, hence the change of ambassador since then, and a different man, different name, I believe. And we were approached by Lulit Mesfin, who is the secretary of the Ethiopian American Association of Portland, last year requesting that we introduce this memorial, which, as Ms. Richardson stated, urges the president to and the Congress to reexamine foreign policy towards Ethiopia. And I am pleased to say that Ms. Mesfin and Jake Thomas, who is a journalist, are both here to testify this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Madam Chairwoman and members of the Education and General Government Committee, my name is Lulit Mesfin. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I represent the Ethiopian American Council of Portland, an organization dedicated to the promotion of human rights, democracy, and the rule of law in Ethiopia. I'm appearing before this committee today to testify in support of Senate Joint Memorial SJM3. I have a prepared testimony which I provided to the committee. The committee staff, I respectfully ask the chair to accept my prepared testimony into the record of the proceeding. Madam Chairwoman, I support Senate Joint Memorial 3 for the following reasons. The memorial recognizes the long and productive friendship that has existed between the United States and Ethiopia. The memorial is prepared in the spirit of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and friendship to the people of Ethiopia. The memorial clearly expresses the democratic sentiments of the people of Oregon in encouraging in the formation of democratic institutions in Ethiopia. The memorial is outstanding in urging the President of the United States to encourage the head of the ruling regime in Ethiopia to release all political prisoners and respect the rule of law. Madam Chairwoman, I support Senate Joint Memorial 3 because it goes a long way in standing up for freedom, human rights, and democracy in Ethiopia, for the democratically elected leaders of the Coalition for Unity and Democracy Party, civil society advocates, human rights defenders, and free press journalists, and against tyranny, persecution, and oppression. Madam Chairwoman, in exactly 13 days, on February 19, 2007, 111 individuals that Amnesty International has declared prisoners of conscience, including opposition party leaders, human rights advocates and defenders, civic society leaders, journalists, and others, will be brought to hear the judgment of a political court that many have described as a kangaroo court. I'm not sure what this political court will do, but I do know that the trumped-up charges made against these prisoners of conscience could result in the death penalty. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nussbaum. Any questions from the committee? I think they're going to look through your materials while we hear from Mr. Thomas, and then we'll come back if we have some questions.
My name is Jacob Thomas, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak for you today. I have a prepared testimony I'd like to read. August of last year, I traveled to Ethiopia, where I worked as a research assistant for an independent journalist. While there, I witnessed firsthand the product of the United States' realist foreign policy. With Washington applying little carrot or stick to the regime of Meles Zenawi, he has little incentive to promote many institutions we take for granted here. The citizens of Ethiopia don't enjoy equal protection under the law, have limited civil liberties, and may risk their lives just for running a blog or owning the wrong book. In Ethiopia, blogs are heavily censored, and any genuinely investigative or critical media outlets have largely been silenced. One of our contacts risked being tortured and killed for running an anonymous blog critical of the government. Before going to Ethiopia, I met with former Assistant Attorney General Alamayo Zemedkun. In vivid detail, he described how the independence of the judicial system has been steadily undermined and how he was intimidated and threatened for resisting. In Ethiopia, I met the son of the aging Haile Shaul, who used to head the opposition party and is now in jail. I also met with Nardus Minasi, the wife of Berhanu Nega, the first elected mayor of Addis Ababa, who has been in jail for over a year. Both described how the country has changed for the worst. While there, I witnessed arbitrary searches of personal property. I met a man who lost the opportunity to go to school or get work because he had opposed the government. I met school children who risked their lives and limbs simply for raising their index and middle fingers in the air. I met scores of people who had their lives turned upside down by the government. Lastly, I met people who were disappointed. They were disappointed with the United States for supporting a regime that stunted their dreams for a more free and democratic Ethiopia. While it may serve our national interests to have a strong ally in the region that will crush Islamists and sustain order, we may one day be dealing with a population that is weary and distrustful towards the United States. Additionally, no one I spoke with in Ethiopia expected the regime to be removed peacefully. Our national interest is tied with this issue. Please give this bill the thoughtful consideration it deserves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you went to Ethiopia and brought back the information that you've just shared with us about what's going on. Any questions by the committee? All right. Well, the Dash 2 amendment simply changes the name of the ambassador because we have a new one, and also changes the number of victims, I believe.
Yes, I believe that was changed according to a report that was put out since we introduced the bill to Legislative Council.
Okay, page 2, line 6, we had 42, and now that's changing to 199. I hope we can keep that number from rising any further. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Can I get this entered in the record?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to, seeing no one else to testify, I'm going to close the public hearing on SJM3. And I will open a work session on SJM3.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to SJM3.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendment to SJM3. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Madam Chair, I move SJM3 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due-pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves SJM3 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due-pass recommendation. Any comments? Discussion? I appreciate Senator Deckert bringing this bill forward, this memorial, and I'm certain it will mean something to our delegation. I appreciated that we had letters given to us in the testimony from our congressional representatives. So with that, would you like to call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Wesley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. SJM3, having received the constitutional majority, is passed. I will assign Senator Deckert to carry that bill. Thank you. Okay, colleagues, we're headed to a public hearing on SB 218.
I'm totally okay with 47 now. I just got a little bad with Tricia and all the folks out there.
Okay. So. Ms. Richardson, you want to tell us about 218?
Happy to, Madam Chair. This is a bill that we brought back from a previous hearing and didn't have a chance to hear. Senate Bill 218 authorizes the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board to determine amount that member of board may receive for performance of official duties.
It also changes the source of payment from school districts to the Department of Education. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And thank you. We just have someone from the department. It's the department's bill. So, Mr. Harness, you want to come forward? And thank you for bearing with us. I know you sat through a long hearing that day, and we didn't get to this bill quick enough.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Randy Harnett with the Department of Education, and I wanted to spend a minute with you and explain why we brought this bill forward. The Fair Dismissal Appeals Board is a statutory board that hears appeals of teachers and administrators who've been dismissed from their employment by the school district. The board consists of 20 members, four categories: 5 administrators, 5 teachers, 5 school board members, and 5 members at large. Within each of those categories, there's an attempt to have represented small, medium, and large school districts. When a teacher or an administrator is dismissed, they have a period of time to submit to the Department of to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board their intent to appeal that action. The appeals board then puts together a panel of 3 members, an at-large, a school board member, and then either a teacher or an administrator, depending on the appellant. Again, the attempt at that point is to pull those teacher or administrator and board members from the appropriate size category. Currently, we have, in the 4 or 5 years that I've worked with the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, I think there's only been at one period of time when we've had a full contingent of members, and obviously that's a difficult. It's difficult to maintain a full contingent of members in any event. But over the years, we've had great difficulty in keeping our members in all of those categories. There are very tight timelines for the board to hear the appeal and issue a decision, so it's critical that we have a full panel or a full board from which to pull those panel members. One of the issues that has come up in our annual meeting, the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board has a statutory requirement to meet annually, and we do that in October. One of the issues that's come up over the last several years, particularly from the teacher members, has been a very wide discrepancy in how the districts, their employers, handle the substitute cost. And we have had examples of districts that cover the cost of obtaining a substitute for a teacher panel member without hesitation. We've also had districts that have asked the teacher members to take personal leave or to cover the sub-costs themselves. And that, while less of a consideration for an administrator, really is still a concern for administrators, in that oftentimes when an administrator is out of the office, the district or the school moves a lead teacher up to handle some of those responsibilities, and there still is the cost to the district of obtaining a substitute. The FDAB, at their annual meeting, we talked about it, the issue at length, and discussed several options. And finally, the decision was to propose authorizing the State Department of Education to pay all FDAB members, regardless of the category from which they, or the category that they represent, an amount. And we had in the back of our minds, honestly, the cost of obtaining a substitute, which right now is about $150. We authorized, or the bill would authorize, the FDAB to set a daily reimbursement by administrative rule, and then that would authorize the Department of Education to pay each of the individual members that amount, as well as the regular expenses of travel and meals and lodging. The FDAB panels sit anywhere between 3 to 5 or 6, depending on the situations every, you know, each year, to hear those appeals. Those appeals last from, you know, 1 to 7 or 8 days sometimes. We, in coming up with an estimate of the fiscal impact, I just kind of took a guess and set a low range and a high range and assumed that a reimbursement rate of approximately $200 and came up to it with a fiscal impact over the biennium of between $22,000 to $37,000. Now, there is no amount in state government that's insignificant, but that is an amount that we could and could cover out of our general fund budget to allow the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board to continue to do its really state-level job, and ask that you consider approving this Senate Bill 218.
Mr. Harnish, I have just a couple questions. The Fair Dismissals Board was established by the legislature in 1971, so that my understanding is that basically it can act as a jury of peers over people who have been discharged, correct?
Correct.
So the legislature must have thought it was important to have this board. So then the second question is, I don't think it's appropriate to ask someone who serves on the board to take a personal day or to bear the cost of service on that board. But why are you setting it at $250 when your testimony is that the cost of a substitute is around $150? Does that factor in the per diem and the lodging and sort of thing?
No, actually, that's, and Senator Walker, we set the $250 because we don't want to come back for a couple years.
Okay, that's fair.
We set the $250 as an upper limit,
okay,
and we authorized the FDAB to establish by rule the daily reimbursement rate, acknowledging that over the next several years that amount will likely increase, and the board could act to increase that by rule without having to come back to the legislature for that change.
That's really quite fair.
Okay.
I understand why you did it that way. That's actually pretty smart. But not more than $250, so that's an upper limit, and
yes,
they can decide by rule. Okay, I'm happy. Anyone else have any questions? Senator Metzger?
Well, I just had a question. It is a current law, but when I was looking at this yesterday before the committee, I was wondering, this is pretty amazing to have a 20-member board. I mean, I'm trying to think of, I mean, our Supreme Court's only 7 members. I mean, is that, I just kind of wonder, from your perspective, is that whatever wisdom went into that 35 years ago, is it necessary to have 20 members on a board?
Senator Walker.
Very few boards, we have anything like that.
Yep.
I mean, we could have 50, but, you know, 20 just seems like an awful lot of people to try and collar around to make a judgment.
Yes. Senator Walker and Senator Metzger, actually, the board is more a pool. There are 20 members from which 3 members are selected to act. So the only action that the entire Fair Dismissal Appeals Board takes as a body would be to approve the administrative rules and at their 1 half-day annual
meeting.
Oh, good.
Okay. Well, you answered the question. That's good.
Okay.
So it's like the Court of Appeals or something, federal, where you have a pool of judges.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Good answer. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill raises an issue that has been a concern for me, participating on a number of, you know, task forces and commissions. We will go to either the dais or around the table, and we have a per diem to fill out. The citizens that participate in that have only mileage and very minor expenses. And I've wondered why the inconsistency when you're asking members to travel from the farthest reaches of the state,
mm-hmm,
and at a great expense to them personally, and to their businesses, why we would not treat them at least in the same way that we as legislators are treated. That's just an editorial comment, not for this bill, but...
Well, I think it's a really appropriate comment that needs to be said, and I actually think we should pay jurors more than $10 a day, but that's another story, because people get put on a jury and sometimes are there for a month or more, and it's a great peril to their livelihood. But I think it sounds to me like you have the support of a committee here.
Thank you.
And there is no further testimony or comments, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 218, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 218.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 218 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 218 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objections? Call the roll just for to give Heather something to do. Besides typing away over there.
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Lexler?
I vote for Heather. That's an aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 218 will move to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I ask the committee's unanimous approval to vote on 47?
We didn't.
We didn't.
Oh.
But you would like to be on Thursday.
Oh. Well, I'd like to do it now.
We just have to get two small amendments, so we'll bring it back Thursday, and you'll have the opportunity to vote then, Senator. Thank you. Colleagues, I think we're going to open a work session on some committee bill introductions. So, Senator Cruz, do you know those are... Just some LCs okay. You have here. Do we have them all for the members?
I am not sure.
Okay. No.
Apparently not if you're asking.
Yeah, okay. That's all right. Usually we have those for the members, so we don't have to read through them, but that's all right.
Take them around beforehand?
No.
We can just do it.
Yeah, we'll do it, okay. And we can have Ms. Richardson just briefly
tell us. Madam Chair, I move LC 1487, LC 2010, and LC 2667 be introduced as committee bills.
Okay. Senator Cruz has moved that LC 1487, 2010, and 2667 be introduced as committee bills. Can you just give us a relating clause, Ms.
Yes.
Richardson?
LC 1487 removes the restriction on public charter schools offering online courses that 50% or more of the students participating have to live in that school district. LC 2010 allows students with asthma to self-administer their medication at school. LC 2667 modifies the definition of disabled individual with regard to public contracting law and procurement of products or services from nonprofit agencies.
All right. Colleagues, these are being introduced as committee bills. They're not. You're not being asked to rule on the merits or anything else. I just ask that you accept them.
I'm sure I just find it amazing that asthma students can't administer their own medicine.
They cannot.
That's just...
And we'll hear all about that.
I just find that incredibly amazing. So.
All right. Any objection to introducing these as committee bills? Okay, then. So moved. All right, colleagues. We're going to go into a work session, and we've got two bills that we need to move out today with your consent. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 392. Ms. Richardson, please remind us if our committee members don't already know what 392 is all about.
Senate Bill 392 lowers the minimum age for required school attendance to 6. It's applicable to children between the ages of 6 and 18 at the beginning of the 2008-2009 school year. There is a -1 amendment as well. Would you like me to speak to that, Madam
Chair? I would like you to do that. Thank you.
The -1 amendment requires the State Board of Education to adopt rules to ensure grade placement for entering 6-year-olds is appropriate to their cognitive development.
Okay. And that amendment, colleagues, both Senator Cruz and Senator Morris had epiphanies after the last hearing. And Senator Morse came up with this language. I ran it by everyone. We all seem to like it. I think Senator Cruz is a little, still a little iffy. We'll let him talk about it. But let's talk about the dash. Can we just make a motion to move the dash one, and then we'll have a conversation?
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 392.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 392. Now we're open for discussion. Senator Morse, do you want to just speak to your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment was brought in response to the concerns that parents have that a child might not be sufficiently advanced in their cognitive development to be arbitrarily placed in school. And what we wanted was the opportunity for a process for parents to withhold their child or place them appropriately. And that we felt that that best should reside with the Board of Education to adopt rules to that effect. One of the problems that exists in an arbitrary lowering of the age is how do you reach out and capture the parents that are refusing for whatever reason to recognize the needs of their children when they should be in school and they're not in school. And I think we heard testimony to that effect that, in fact, that does occur. But at the same time, allow flexibility for parents that believe that their child is not ready. And that's the intent of this amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Burke is in the back of the room. Patrick Burke from the department. Could you come forward? I'd like you to, before I move further into discussion, I'd like you to respond to Senator Morse's question, because I had asked him to have a conversation with you and tell us what the practical effect of this amendment would be, if you would, please. First, identify yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. We have had a chance to talk with Senator Morse's staff about the amendment, and we've indicated that we have no major objection to the amendment. The practical implication is that if the student has not been in school prior record, so we have basically a situation where a student has received no instruction, either homeschooling or in private school or daycare program, it's already fairly standard practice for there to be some assessment of the learning needs of the child upon entering a formal school setting. So there would, in most cases, be an attempt to look at the language development and early mathematics development of the child. And if there is any indication of any type of learning disability, the parent always has the right to request a more in-depth analysis of their child if there is any concern along those lines. So I want to be clear, in bringing the bill, we are not trying to force parents. Obviously, we have no interest in becoming a wedge between education and parents. Parents are their child's first and primary educator. However, when the child enters school, we believe it would be fairly routine to determine what the appropriate placement would be. So the bill is not trying to force kids into first grade. The six-year-old may indeed benefit from kindergarten. You may also find a situation where the six-year-old is ready for advanced placement and would be better placed in second grade or higher. It's just our concern that waiting until age seven before the student is receiving formal education is creating potentially putting that child at risk of not learning at an appropriate rate as they continue through school.
Thank you. Mr. Burke, can I ask you this question? How many students, we had written testimony last time from a first grade teacher in my district who talked about how one of her students had missed a number of days, well over 50 days, and they couldn't do anything until the child turned seven. And then suddenly the child started coming to school again because
correct.
The parents were held to task. Do you know how many cases like that you have around the state? They're all local district cases, so I'm not sure you are aware.
They are local cases, and Madam Chair, I don't have off the top of my head an exact figure statewide. We could get that information for you. These are complex cases in we do need to distinguish between issues of child neglect and what we're talking about with the bill. I really see these as one mm-hmm. is an advocacy for when is the appropriate time for a child to receive instruction and what type of instruction. There is, of course, the other side of this, which is when is a parent being neglectful by not providing appropriate education or assuring that their child receives education. These cases, in my own experience, tend to be in the area of between 1 to 5% of the enrollment of the school. That would be that's based on my years as a principal. What my experience has been is that most parents are very anxious to get their children into school and support them being there. But in these cases, as you mentioned, it is important to have a tool to intervene.
And the second question, final question for me is, the State Board of Education shall adopt rules. Can you sort of tell us how you would do that and what it would look like?
The rulemaking process is established in statute. There would be an initial first read. The department would review the law and what the directive and the legislation would be. We would prepare a document for first read by the board. At that point, the board then is required to hold public hearings on that matter, and the hearings officer reports back to the board on the results of that hearing. The board goes into a second reading, and at that point either chooses to adopt the rule or send it back to staff for further work.
Great. So lots of opportunity for public input.
Quite a bit, yes.
Thank you. I'll share with you all my emails. Senator Cruz, did you have a comment?
Just a question at this point. I'll save my comment for the bill itself. Mr. Burke, there's nothing in the -1 amendment that changes anything in the bill as it was written. It just adds, but it changes nothing in the bill. Would that be correct?
That's my understanding, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other questions of Mr. Burke? All right. Mr. Burke, thank you very much. I appreciate that you were here. So, colleagues, we have a -1 amendment. Is there any further discussion from the committee? I tried to be sensitive to the concerns of all the emails that we've received. And I'm just going to state this for the record because I need to let people out in TV land understand that the people who serve in this building are public servants, and our staff work hard to serve you as well. And I will not tolerate my staff being intimidated on the telephone or by email. There is absolutely no reason for anyone to be vitriolic to those of us who serve the public. It's much easier to state your position in a thoughtful manner without intimidating folks, and I just don't want to see that happen again. That's not fair to the staff who work hard, and it's certainly not fair to anyone else in this process who knows better. So with that being said, I would take no other comments. I would take a vote on the -1 amendment, and why don't we ask for a roll call vote on that one.
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Weston?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. All right. The -1 to Senate Bill 392 has passed. We're now at the next motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 392 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 392 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, let me say I really appreciate your attempt to accommodate all concerns on this, as you have with all the legislation that we have been dealing with this session. You're very gracious and thoughtful and considerate, and I truly appreciate that. However, quite honestly, Madam Chair, you made a statement for the public. I'll make one too. We can have some very vigorous and serious disagreements among the members of the Oregon Senate, but at the end of the day, we're all friends, and we're all here with the same purpose, and that's to serve the public. So. Yeah.
voting.
That's another informational thing for those listening in TV land or radio land, I guess. I'm still not sure, Madam Chair. I understand the intent and what we're driving towards, and I support that. And I know there are still a considerable group of folks who are opposed. I have had conversations with them and advised them to have discussions with folks on the House side if they want further amendments on this, because it is moving, and I know that. I guess from my perspective, the solution could have been very simple here, and that would have been basically to say that, if what we're after is the fact that we cannot want 6-year-olds who are enrolled in school, we cannot compel them to attend, and clearly we cannot, the simple solution would have been to say that anybody, any student at any age who is enrolled in public school is compelled to attend. That would include 5-year-olds as well. If they've enrolled in public kindergarten program, then we can compel their attendance. That would have been a very simple solution, but we could not seem to get there, and that's unfortunate. But, like I said, I appreciate the thoughtful discussion we've had on this issue.
Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd just like to compliment the entire committee. I know this was somewhat of a divisive issue, and I think what Oregonians are seeing is the committee process at work in its finest. I think we accommodated some of the legitimate concerns that were raised and compromised in a fashion that addresses the concerns, very legitimate concerns, on both sides of this issue. So just as a general comment, I'd like to thank the entire committee for our willingness to work through a difficult and thorny issue and arrive at an appropriate piece of public policy.
Thank you, Senator Wesson. I appreciated that, too. It was just grand, I thought, that both Senator Cruz and Senator Morse at the same time were thinking about alternatives, and I was willing to roll with that. I think we've reached one. Senator Cruz may think that the Minnesota law is a better approach, but, let him have that conversation in the House. I think we've sort of worked it through. I feel comfortable with the bill. Apparently, the majority of the committee does. And I do want to thank all the people who have written and emailed and phoned. I just want to caution them to be a little more civil about that sometimes. Not everyone was that way, but there were some instances of that, and it was upsetting to my staff. So with that, I think we will vote on the bill. Heather.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. Senate Bill 392, having received the constitutional majority, is passed, and I'll carry that bill. I would wish that someone else. It is my bill and Senator Devlin's bill. So we will move right along to Senate Bill 214. I'll open a work session on that. Mr. Kafouri wanted to address the committee. Mr. Kafouri, I looked at the materials, and I don't really think there's an issue here, but I'm going to give you just about 2 minutes, because it's not really my problem. You didn't know about it before, and we can't keep revisiting bills. But I'm going to let Ms. Richardson speak to an amendment, and then you can come up and address the committee.
Madam Chair, the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 214 exempts one school district from the requirement to qualify as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. It also extends the requirement to qualify as a 501c3 to all other charter schools that open or renew charters after July 1st, 2007, trying to address a couple of concerns that were brought up in our hearing prior.
And we did have a hearing prior on this, colleagues, and quite a discussion. I have 4 pages of notes. It's really hard to take notes when you're chairing a committee, but I did get 4 pages of notes on January 18th of 07, and Mr. Kafouri has an issue he'd like to talk to us about. So would you come forward, sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Zafori. I'm here today representing the Apollo Group. The Apollo Group is the parent organization for the University of Phoenix, and we have also recently bought a company called Insight Schools Incorporated. I apologize for this lateness, and I'm very grateful to the chair for her courtesy in allowing me. I will be very brief. Insight Schools is an online high school. We are headquartered in Portland, Oregon, but we are not operating presently in Portland, in the state of Oregon, due to a law which you just introduced a bill, as a committee bill just now, which will address that issue. That also is coming up this afternoon in House Bill 2037, the same issue in the House Committee on Education. We are operating in the state of Washington. Our model up there is that we are a public charter school in a district in the state of Washington. The students come from all over the state of Washington as students. They are legally students at that charter school and members of that school district. Without going into a great deal of detail about this, you'll hear about this a lot more. I want to be brief this morning. It is a free program. The students all receive a laptop and have online instruction. Our target audience is not students who are presently in school, but students who are presently not in school. For example, teen mothers who have daycare problems and need to stay home, students with medical problems, students who are your typical dropouts, students who are very bright and are not succeeding in a regular school. Classes are small, 18 to 20. This is not just a students watching somebody talk to them online. There's a lot of interaction. There's interaction among the students, interaction with the teacher. There's a counselor for every 75 students. It's a regular high school program. It's just that it's online instead of being in a classroom.
Okay, Mr. Kavori, I'm going to interrupt you because I appreciate hearing about the program, but I need to understand how it is that this bill impacts the program you're talking about.
Madam Chair, one of my jobs as a lobbyist, and perhaps my most important job as a lobbyist, is to point out unintended consequences in bills. This bill was aimed, as I understand it, at school districts setting up their own charter schools, and inadvertently what you've done here is to outlaw for-profit schools, for example, my school, Insight Schools, from operating a public charter school, because you have to be a 501c3. Now, we could set up a 501c3 and then have that 501c3 contract to us. I don't think that makes sense. I think it goes against the spirit of what this law would be should it pass. I've been working with University of Phoenix for a number of years, and I know that you can have high-quality, private, for-profit education. And I think this bill is not intended to do that, to block that, but that's what it does. I realize it's late in the game. I'm not presumptuous enough to ask you to hold this bill. What I would like to ask, Madam Chair, is that you let the House Committee understand that it was not the intent of this committee to prohibit for-profit online schools.
Thank you, Mr. Kavori. Any questions? I'm going to, in response, have two folks come up and testify. If you want to step back, Mr. Green and Ms. Wimmer Whalen, can you address the issues Mr. Kavori just raised? Because I really don't see it the same way.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. A couple of things. First, I think Mr. Kavori may have misstated. Washington State does currently not allow charter schools. They were, I believe, enacted by statute and then repealed by an initiative twice. So Washington State does not currently have a charter school law. Oregon, however, does. And I was part of the work group in 1999 that created the law, and it was a specific policy discussion at that time that when a sponsoring entity, and in our law it's the school district first, and then if they deny it, it gets appealed up to the state board, that they shall contract with a nonprofit entity. There is an attorney general's opinion that was issued, I believe, in 2000-2001 that does say, however, that that nonprofit entity may contract with a for-profit company to provide the educational opportunities. And that's what's occurring in, I believe, three charter schools across the state right now. But it was a specific policy decision by this body back in 1999 to say, this is going to be a public charter school operating under public tax dollars. We want the sponsors to contract with a nonprofit board to provide those educational services. If that board wants to contract subsequently with a for-profit, that's their decision. But the accountability loop back to the locally elected board or to the state board was with that nonprofit board and that contract or charter agreement that was discussed. Believe me, we had visceral debates about those issues in 1999,
sure,
and the agreement around the table was nonprofit corporation. And the reason was taxpayer dollars going to provide public education. The accountability loop should be between that nonprofit board and that locally elected board or the state board.
That was my understanding as well, Ms. Whalen.
Madam Chair, for your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with OEA. I don't really have anything factual to add, except that if it were true that this would be an illegal operation, we wouldn't have the Connections Academy in Sile, for example, operating. That's a for-profit organization that's contracting with the nonprofit and the school district.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I can just speak to the Dash Ones, we did get together in a work group on it. I had brought up several issues with regard to requiring a charter school, each charter school, to have its own nonprofit board. That was a rather fun discussion to have with several people in the room, I'm sure, as your committee administrator may be able to attest to. But my understanding from the Department of Education is they have asked the Attorney General for an opinion on that matter.
Okay.
We're willing to wait for that Attorney General's opinion to see exactly what the AG says with that matter. As it relates to the Dash Ones, we're fine with the Dash Ones as they currently read, because it does exempt, and I think Senator Cruz, you were the one who brought this up, a single school district from this requirement because of those entities and those towns not having enough people maybe to comprise both boards. And the Department of Education was in agreement with that exception as well.
Thank you. And I apologize that in the work you all were subjected to some rather severe language by one of the participants, and had I been in the room, I would not have allowed that. And feel free in the future to just walk out of a work group if you can't have a discussion with someone who refuses to be a participant without resorting to language like that. Questions, Senator Cruz? Do you have a question of anyone here?
No, Madam Chair. I once again appreciate the commendation. I think this is taking care of my concern, and I support the Dash Ones.
All right. Thank you both. Colleagues, we are in work session. Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash One Amendment to Senate Bill 214.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash One Amendment to Senate Bill 214. Any discussion about those amendments? We accommodated you. Great. No objection. Those are approved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 214 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 214 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please, Heather.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator
Westland? Can I vote on 47? I really got to vote on 47.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Walker? Aye. Senate Bill 214 received a constitutional majority as a pass, and I'm going to give that to Senator Cruz. But just wait, Senator Westland, I've got one coming up for you to carry soon. All right, committee, gosh, we're done early, which is just so unusual. We try to make sure we use all of our time, but I'm happy to give you a few moments to return messages and emails and actually take a break in the day. So thank you all. We're adjourned until Thursday.